Rona Balfour. I've signed the hotel's register, quite truthfully. It's there for all to see, clear as day. But who knows where to find me? Out here on the Mull, the summer is almost over. Most of the holiday homes have been double-locked, curtains half-drawn, gates closed. We're the hotel's last guests. The village store is running low on supplies. The tin ice cream sign outside creaks rustily on its battered stand. It's not good timing, but I needed to get away when I did. Back there in Edinburgh, in the flat, something in me seemed to snap. I drove up, decided on the west coast. Roddy doesn't know where I am. All he has is the message I left for him, on yellow paper. I'm taking the car. Look on the bright side. It's still summer. You won't need an umbrella for walking. I'll ring. Rona. No love. No kisses. Not when you're running out of a relationship for the first time. There are eight of us staying in the hotel. The youngish owners, the Meekies, are courteous, but I get the feeling they're looking beyond us to the final day next Tuesday, when they'll have the place to themselves again. Who are we all? There's a Perth couple, the McGregors, 40-somethings, married, only I very much doubt if they're married to each other. They're too earnest together. They don't have that verbal shorthand when they talk. It's as if they're really discussing everything for the first time.
He doesn't like to let her out of his sights.
She has a slithery way of walking, swaying her hips, which is intended to make him even more possessive. She wants him to suppose he is in control, but all the time she's tying him tighter and tighter around her little finger. The two office girls from Dundee are here because hotels are cheaper at the season's close. The Med is more their scene, but they're on the way back from a boisterous wedding further north. Neither has any intention of settling down in life. Geez, no. They talk endlessly about boys, though. Who's going out with whom? Clubs? Discos? Cafes? Why did Janice wear that outfit and hasn't Tina put on weight? And didn't Scott look hunky in a kilt? The two childless widows from their genteel Glasgow suburb have grown to resemble one another. Dandelion head perms with a bluish tint. Eyebrows plucked to sceptical arcs, taut, prim wee mouths. On their late husband's pensions, they occasionally indulge themselves like this, with economical treats. But in common with so many other Scots women of their generation, they've forgotten how to enjoy the business. They tirelessly run down the modern world, and smugly congratulate themselves that they've run tight ships all their lives, just as their mothers and grandmothers did, so there's very little anyone can teach them, thank you very much. They skim through their tabloids, but prefer to read their library books, couthy Scots family sagas with battling heroines they like to identify with. Really, though, their curiosity about the world dried up years ago, when they realised they had just as much canniness and nouse as they needed to get by. Mr. Sproat is a mystery. He scarcely speaks, except to himself. I've heard him proclaiming solo down on the shore. An actor, perhaps, to judge from his sleek clothes and raised chin. But I don't recognise the face, or the name. Is he sullen because nobody else recognises him either? He slurps down his soup, wolfs his food without chewing at it adequately, as only a man who lives alone would do. Some terrible anger seems to live there inside him. One evening at dinner, his fingers snapped the stem of his wine glass. Another time he picked up a live coal that had fallen out of the fire they light at night. He tossed it back into the grate, and then he pushed his scorched hand into his trouser pocket, as if he was punishing it. From the Mull, 170-odd miles away, It's difficult to remember what Roddy and I quarrelled about. Something was building up, so maybe it doesn't matter in the end, the precise reason. Looking out the windows of the flat all summer and seeing only streets and more streets and the same unchanging blue sky. Waiting for friends or relations to call on the phone. Having to consult the calendar diary of social engagements on the wall. Planning the next meal. What to buy at the shops. Coping daily with the serious heat that would have gathered under the hot tiles of the roof. All along we had been trying to please one another. I, Roddy, and Roddy, me. Anxious not to put a foot wrong. Watering down our opinions. Not actually being our individual selves, but instead claiming some mythical and impossible togetherness. Two in one. These few days pass. I eat, I go for walks, I've even swum a couple of times in the bay, in the chilly water, but with the sun hot on my back. At night I sleep the sleep of the just, although I can't believe I deserve it. Why here? Well, why not? Here, in the circumstances, is as good as anywhere else. Our two good-time girls en route from the wedding eavesdrop on the widows. They smile and raise their eyebrows. They giggle, snigger when the women can't hear them, and sometimes, I'm sure, when they can. The girls with their lives ahead of them, an endless spree of days to squander as they want. It doesn't cross their minds that they could conceivably turn into women who are always comparing now with then. To the girls it's not frightening, not terrifying, because aging doesn't apply to them. The old women's nattering is pathetic, that's all. So what else can they do but laugh it off, shrug their shoulders, take out their lipsticks and eyeliner, and make up their faces in full view, while the widows tut-tut at their lack of social grace. I see Mr. Sproat down on the shore. He doesn't see me. He's sitting in the long blue shadow of a rock, with a gin bottle stuck in the sand beside him. He's laughing to himself. The sound makes a little echo against the rock. I think something or someone must be driving him quite mad. I get talking to the girl who makes the beds, Shona. She smiles at me cheerily. Her top lip rides up over her metal brace, an authentic smile. She likes it. When the normal people come, she says, the families. When I ask her, she tells me that she wants to get married herself and have her own home to run, and hear the bairns running round the garden. Her smiles are infectious. She makes me feel better. Lighter, for having spoken to her. Shona is one of the blessed, although she is too unself-conscious to realise it. There's an outburst of hissing outside my door. The Perth husband. A whispered plea. But the wife, so-called, runs ahead of him into their room and bangs the door shut behind her, locks it. He rat-tat-tats, whispers promises through the keyhole, more and more promises, until she finally relents and the key turns. From my window after dinner, I watch the owners, the Michis, down on the lawn. Their day is over. And soon their working year will be too. They both shed a few years when they're off duty. She kicks off her shoes to walk on the grass in her stocking soles. He takes the shoes from her and carries them in one hand. His other arm he lays across her shoulders. She draws close into his side. They know to skirt the cloud of midges by the rhododendron brake. I hear their voices burbling. Then gentle, contented laughter. Another week on, and the hotel will be closed. I continue to watch them, the couple. Now they're silent. They don't need any more words. But some of us still do. I call Roddy on my bedside phone. He picks up the receiver.
Rona?
I catch my breath. Rona, is that you? He sounds relieved. I can hear little explosions of breath, his excitement. I was hoping when it rang. He's trying to put a shine on his words. I tell him, without having foreseen, I should tell him, that I'll be coming back the day after tomorrow.
Good,
he says.
Good. I'm so glad to hear that.
No questions. I thought there would be questions. He's letting me know that he trusts me. Only one query, of the most general sort.
How's it been? He asks.
It's been... I hesitate over my verdict for a second or two. It's been all right. I sit on in the room once we've finished, in the gloaming. Something has come to its conclusion, I feel. The halcyon part of our life together. But I can't be too sorry. It wasn't the whole truth. We'd given one another no freedom to do anything. People without freedom become, I think, clichés. Look at my fellow guests. Now we have to learn to coexist maturely. As two individuals who share a home and many interests, who respect and love one another, but don't necessarily agree about every single thing. This is the challenge to us, getting balance right. But this is also how we will survive. Over a last merry drink, the girls from Dundee are comparing tans and comparing boys, marking their friends out of 10. Scott, Ian, Ali, Kenny, Billy, Jason. They're hypercritical. They imagine they're free agents, calling all the shots ultra-modern new women. What they don't see is that by trying to put men in their place, they've ended up as obsessives, more in men's thrall than ever. Meanwhile, in their quiet corner of the lounge, the two widows feel the library novels becoming heavier and heavier in their hands. Their heads start to nod. Their prim mouths drop open. Perhaps it's their husbands they find flitting among the shadows of dreamland. Their marriages weren't perfect, and neither woman has pretended to the other that it was. Some matters you keep secret, even how much you still miss the man you never quite fathomed, but whose life was woven so close with yours, like warp and woof. Upstairs, I can't get to sleep. The bedclothes are too warm. But never mind. I'm relaxed. I'm happy. In a slightly melancholic kind of way. Earlier, I heard the Michis going through their list of repairs, which colour of paint for which rooms. At dinner, one of the widows said she'd spotted some swallows flying south across the bay. The early departures. Sunday it is. I'll go then. Before the weather changes. Before they air the building and take the curtains down for cleaning and the mattresses are left standing out in the corridors. I want to get back to Edinburgh. To Roddy. To begin again. With the windscreen visor lowered against the sun and the day still gluey, munificent with heat.
Gilly Bond was reading The End of the Season by Ronald Frame. It was produced by David Hunter.